in which you have an E-field going through the center of it, or whatever it is. How could you measure it in the, you need both. You know, it's, how can you measure both without ledgers and resistance? You can't make a measurement without having the other components. All components must be satisfied. If don't, you don't have complete loops. You don't have complete equations. You have a broken discontinuity. But yes, whenever you're making a measurement, if you have H, you must have an E field. Whenever you're measuring an E field, you must have an H field. You can't have one without the other, Dick. K2LW, K2QIQ.
Okay. Assume now that I'm taking my clamp-on ammeter, I'm measuring a piece of 8-gauge or 10 or 4-gauge wire. I clamped it around a piece of 4-gauge wire. The voltage drop on my piece of wire in the vicinity of where I'm making the measurement is microvolts. The voltage drop across that wire by Ohm's law. So it's a 60-cycle signal going down that wire. I'm measuring AC amperes with my clamp-on ammeter. The clamp-on ammeter, I could either have across its ferrite jaws, either a solenoid coil that measures voltage or a Hall effect device across a gap on the 6 o'clock position of it. The jaws open at 12 o'clock. So there I am measuring pure H at a 60 cycle rate of the current. In other words, the current flowing through that wire creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field is flowing through the jaws of that clamp-on ammeter. The Hall effect device on the clamp ammeter is measuring the H. There is no E in the vicinity of that clamp-on ammeter. In that example, I'm measuring pure H in isolation. Agree or disagree? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Completely disagree that around, in order to be enough to move, just to create the waveform that you're looking for, you are around a high-flex pulse of the H. Have an eye, a vent in an ampere, to get it to turn, to move. But it's, you know, the sinusoidal waveform, a DC, it doesn't matter. There must be a vent in an ampere. And so if you have a vent over an open or anything, you're going to have a vent per meter. And that vent per meter will create an ampere, an ampere turn, which is going to be representative of an H field. And test for a Gauss. All of these units work together. In your making your measurement, you're making a measurement at the point at which voltage drop is near or at zero, but it's still, E field is still represented around the outside. So it's just that, yes, you can measure around from points to the aha, and it's point by voltage to zero, but the E field is already established around the whole point to make the current flow in the first place. So it's really just a point of, okay, if you move to the lowest voltage point, if the E field is still there, the E field must have been there, but it moves. The only time that you will have one E field is when the voltage is truly zero, which means that there's no current. If there's no current, then there's no H. So, yes, when you draw your E and H fields, there's a point of minima and maxima, of course there is. So when I is zero, H is zero, E is zero. In any measurement, because you measure it around 6 kilohertz, and things are always being measured in loops. Now, when you're in 3 space, there is no more loop. You have progressive time and domain in one direction, and you have geometry of the H field with relationship to 377 ohms, which all add 90 degrees. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
I've got 2 experiments now, Glenn. I just want to make a measurement of H independent of E, if possible. I'm going to give you these 2 experiments, and you're going to say it can be done or can't be done. Experiment number one, just to be ridiculous, I've got a 1,000,000-volt DC battery. A piece of wire comes out of that battery. My clamp-on ammeter is on that wire. The load on that wire, 10 feet away from me, is a 1 megaohm. Very high power resistor. Don't worry about that. So I got 1,000,000 volts flowing through the wire, going into a load of 1,000,000 ohms. And the wire, of course, goes back to the battery. And that clamp-on ammeter measures 1 ampere. That's experiment number one. Experiment number two, I walk over to the 1-volt battery with with an identical size piece of wire, clamp on ammeter on the piece of the wire. It goes over to a 1 ohm resistor. So 1 million volts is the E, but the clamp on ammeter didn't know it. It measured 1 amp on the 1 million volt power supply into the 1 mega ohm resistor. The same clamp on ammeter on the 1 volt power supply, DC battery, into a 1 ohm resistor, measured 1 ampere again. I got very different E's. I'm saying that clamp on ammeter is measuring only H, because it's got a Hall effect device. So for very different E's, I measure the same H. Where am I going wrong? KCQQIQ, K2RIW?
Well, it's just even the makeup of what a Hall effect device is doing. You have to create an E field in the opposite direction. It doesn't matter how you're creating 1 ampere. Even if you're making 1 ampere turn through your sensing device, it's irrelevant to whether it's done with a million volts or it's done with 1 volt. The fact is that you need a backward EMF in the secondary side of the Hall effect device in order to blank the direction to determine if you have 1 ampere in there. I mean, so your E field now is on the secondary side. It has to be done somewhere. So, you know, it's whether it's taking place on the bird side or on the sensing side, how you're creating your hot device to create a backing EMF to block the 1 ampere turn to know that there is 1 ampere in the wire. It's irrelevant. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, let's climb inside that Hall effect device. My particular Hall effect device happens to be a piece of semiconductor material. It's roughly a rectangular piece of semiconductor material. The Hall effect device, in order for it to work, it's got a separate power supply with a contact at the 12 o'clock position and a contact at the 6 o'clock position. The power supply is across it. A constant current flows through 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock position from a DC power supply. I have two sensing leads on the Hall effect device. One at 9 o'clock, one at 3 o'clock. And I'm measuring differential voltage between the two. Right now, I'm measuring 0 volts between 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock. I place a steady state magnetic field going through the Hall effect device. The steady state magnetic field takes the charged particles that were flowing from 12 o'clock towards 6 o'clock and deflects them by Lenz's law. Because they become deflected, the sensing positions at 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock now see a differential voltage. So yes, there is a power supply on the Hall effect device. It senses pure magnetic field of the environment. That magnetic field creates a deflection. The deflection of the charged particles flowing through the Hall effect device create a differential volt between 9 and 3. In my opinion, that Hall effect device, with its self-contained, thoroughly independent power supply, is measuring pure H field. That's what makes the differential voltage between 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock. And it is not sensitive to the E field of the outside world. To my mind, that is a pure H field sensing device. Where am I wrong on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
It's basically measuring ampere turn. It's really not measuring H. How does that measure H? It's measuring basically I. So you can measure the current in the wire with a Hall effect device, but is it giving you H data?
I could take that Hall effect device that I just described, take a steady state bar magnet, bring it near that Hall effect device, and I am not moving the magnet. The magnet has got a steady state magnetic field. I orient it correctly to the Hall effect device. The power supply that's internal to the Hall effect device has charged particles flowing from 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock. The presence of the magnetic field from the bar magnet is taking those electrons that normally flow straight, and now they flow in a curved line because of the magnetic field, and I think it's Lenz's law, Faraday's law, whoever. Magnetic reflection. That makes a differential voltage between 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock position of the Hall effect device, and my operational amplifier there senses that. Pure, steady state magnetic field, nothing is changing, except that the deflection of the charged particles flowing through the Hall effect device, isn't that measuring nothing but H field and representing it as volts between 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock? Isn't that the way a Hall effect device works? KCQQIQ, K2LIW?
Not exactly, Dick. What's actually happening is that you're measuring ampere turns. See, one thing interesting about transformers, Hall effect devices, is that there's a very, very neat identity about ampere turns. Ampere turns are always equal regardless of coupling. So you can have varying E in a magnetic device, and the ampere turns will always be stacked directly. This is not true with volts and transformers. I think we had this discussion one time before. So because you always have that relationship to M turns, in magnetic devices, in closed paths, that's a beautiful relationship in transformers. It's actually what makes the magic of how a transformer works. All that the Hall-effect device is doing is removing bias. In other words, once you have DC on your signal, what you're doing is just getting the bias in one direction that you can bet the bias to determine a non-changing feedback in a steady-state DC. So you're basically measuring DC currents. That's what Hall-effect devices do. Now, they're not truly measuring H. And if you have chromatic in the field of the Hall-effect device, really what you're doing is you're upsetting the magnetic field intensity of the Hall-effect sensor, and what you're doing is you're creating an interference, so it doesn't make the correct ampere measurement. Which IW, which is like you.
Hey,
dude,
Jack. Code 2. The magnetic field that I apply at the neck of the tube, the magnetic field is at right angles to the axis of the tube. I've got a bunch of electrons flowing from the cathode to the gun assembly of the neck of the tube and going toward the phosphor. The presence of the magnetic field takes those flow of electrons and deflects them. So whenever a magnetic field, and if that was the right-hand rule, I've got moving charge particles, I've got a right angle magnetic field, and I get another right angle of deflection. So the deflection I get in a cathode ray tube and the deflection of charged particles I get in a Hall effect device, is there a difference in the mechanism of that deflection? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
You keep on using the word particles, but what's actually happening in a cathode ray tube is that the magnetic field is deflecting the electron field, or the E field. It just so happens that E field, just in relationship to H field, will have an effect on any moving particle through the center. So it's the deflection of the E field that's actually the cause of the right angle H field that's creating the deflection of the particles through that wave as it goes through the middle. So in other words, you're creating a deflection to the path because E fields and H fields are at right angles to each other. So when you're modifying a magnetic path around the outside of deflection, what you're doing is you're moving the E field, which allows the particles to shift direction, and you can do these things in the CRT tube.
As I see it, Glenn, those electrons flowing from that toward that phosphor of that cathode ray tube are individual charged particles that most people call electrons. In theory, I know exactly how many coulombs, 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, is the amount of charge on each and every electron. I know what path they are taking if I don't disturb them. I know how fast they're moving because I know how many volts I've applied. So I've got these individual charged particles called electrons moving from the cathode phosphor of that cathode ray tube. Once I establish a magnetic field at right angles to that velocity of those charged particles, they become deflected, and I think that's Lenz's law. Okay? Inside of the Hall effect device, the exact same electrons are flowing through that semiconductor material. Before I predictable manner, predictable rate, predictable amount of charge from the 12 o'clock position toward the 6 o'clock position of this flat piece of material called Hall effect. I now establish a magnetic field at right angles. They become deflected. They don't move directly from 12 o'clock toward 6 o'clock. They move from 12 o'clock towards 5 o'clock. They're being deflected by the magnetic field. The two sensing devices on the semiconductor device at 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock see a differential voltage. So, in the Hall effect device, I'm deflecting the electrons flowing through the semiconductor. In the cathode ray tube, I'm deflecting the electrons that are flowing through that stream between cathode and phosphor. Is there a difference? KC2QIQ, KQLIW?
The principle is the same, but are there many differences? Yes. But the principle is the same. I mean, I agree with you on principle, yes. So whenever you have B fields and H fields, they're always related. So whether you're doing it in a Hall effect device, with a magnetic field, and the center effect on the electron flowing curves and seven areas, especially moving at frequency, absolutely. They're all tied together and related. I think that's where you're getting back to the same point or the same identity that you had mentioned before. So whenever you have B fields, you have H fields. Whenever you have B fields, you have curves. Wherever you have curves, you have voltages. Wherever you have voltages, you have resistance. So what realistically is happening is that whenever you're looking at a circuit in where power is being generated, you have volts, you have amperes, you have resistance, you have a local around that circuit. So Kirchhoff's law, Lenz's law, all these loops. Around that first loop, you're going to have, you're going to have E, and you're going to have H. But now what happens is that's all in a path length or a circuit. You know, the electrical name is a circuit. The magnetic path is the path length. Now, what happens is that path moves into 3-3. And we've got away from the kinetic end of things to the potential end of things to the space. So that's the orientation of the DNA consequences. That's enough for me tonight. Here's what I do. KC2QIQ.
When it comes to the deflection of those electrons in that cathode ray tube, it is my belief that that is a pure H-field sensing device. If I'm only looking at deflection, it is only sensing H-field. I could prove that by running that cathode ray tube and its power supply in a separate package, and now I could take that whole package connected to a 100,000 volt power supply and raise the whole package 100,000 volts above Earth. The deflection inside of that cathode ray tube that I see on the phosphor would not change. By same token, I can take the Hall effect device with its separate power supply, and it is or isn't sensing that magnetic field that I've applied with a bar magnet. I could take the whole package of the Hall effect device, connect that package to a 100,000 volt power supply, raise it above Earth by 100,000 volts, and the Hall effect device would not change in its reading. I'm using those two examples to say that the cathode ray tube and the Hall effect device in those examples is looking at and indicating nothing but H field or B field. It is not an E field sensor of the outside world. Do you agree or disagree? K2LIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Completely disagree. And I'm going to give you why this is. Because the Hall effect device is not an H sensor. It's a current sensor. Just like your CRT But let me do this experiment with you. We talked about a chamber before. And we put a Hall effect device inside it with this CRT, however you want to create through it, that you're testing in your Hall effect device. And with the same chamber, we're also going to put a CRT in there, operating doing its thing in another area. Two completely unrelated circuits. Now what I'm going to do is in that same chamber, let's say I do it over these mobile lamps, and I'm going to get myself a nice, powerful RF generator and an antenna, and I'm going to stick it in there. And I'm going to set it to 100 megahertz, and I'll put in 3 volts per meter. Do you think that's not how it's set device would be perfect? Maybe not. I'll put in 10 volts per meter. Maybe I'm going to disturb those devices. is the really centered sensor meteor? Is it relative to the pressure? Of course it is. So if it's right, then you put a little thing in there, and then it's going to put it. You're going to be sure that I'm going to make it in. It's pretty just as good.
Okay, let me back one step back. You said a Hall effect device is not an e-field sensor. It's a current sensor. Without a doubt, to turn the Hall effect device on, I have a certain amount of current flowing from the 12 o'clock position toward the 6 o'clock position. That's the biasing current. And what happens when a magnetic field is present is that the particles of current called electrons flowing through the semiconductor material called Hall effect device become deflected. Instead of flowing directly from 12 o'clock toward 6 o'clock, they flow from 12 o'clock down toward 5 o'clock or toward 7 o'clock. That deflection of the electrons is sensed as a differential voltage between the 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock position. You said it's a current sensor. I say it's a voltage sensor. It's converting H field into voltage. The 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock position, those two terminals are going into a field effect operational amplifier. No current is flowing into that operational amplifier. Only the differential voltage is flowing between 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock is what the operational amplifier is sensing. I say the Hall effect device, yes, it has current flowing through it to bias it. But when it senses an H field, it is not sensing the E field of the outside world. It is only sensing the H field of the outside world impinging on that semiconductor material that is producing a differential voltage that goes into my infinite impedance op-amp. No current flows into the op-amp, and yet that thing senses H field. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I think what you're saying, Nick, and let me see if I'm hearing you right on this. What you're really saying is that the Hall effect device is really an ampere sensor. It's related to the current that's flowing through the wire, which is going to have an H magnitude in that path length. But I guess the reason why I am having a little trouble when you keep on calling the Hall effect sensor in H-field sensors, I can change the geometry of the Hall effect device. I can make the Hall effect device with a 1 centimeter opening. I can make the Hall effect device with a 1 inch opening. I can make the Hall effect device with a 5 foot opening inside. Okay? So you can vary the path length of your Hall effect device to whatever diameter you want to go to or whatever opening you hole you want in the middle. What I'm trying to tell you about the Hall effect device is not an H-field sensor. It's because if you take a 5 foot diameter Hall effect device or a 1 centimeter, one millimeter opening in your Hall effect device, you run a piece of wire through it, put 1 ampere in it, no matter where that wire sits inside it, what's going to happen is you're going to measure the same ampere in that Hall effect device. But let me tell you something. You move that wire from the top of the Hall effect sensor to the bottom of the Hall effect sensor, the H field is going to be different no matter where you move that wire. Do you agree? KC2QIQ.
We've got a problem with terms here. Yes, in the past we talked about putting a Hall effect device in the gap of the ferrite circular jaws of a clamp-on ammeter. I've now removed the Hall effect device from the clamp-on ammeter. I'm looking at the Hall effect device under my microscope on the table. It is a piece of semiconductor material. It's a sheet of semiconductor material that is, let me pick a number, a couple thousandths of an inch thick. It is maybe, in my example, 10,000 inches high between the 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock position. And it's a couple of thousandths wide between the 9 o'clock and 6 o'clock position. There is no gap of any kind in the Hall effect devices. It is a sheet of semiconductor material. It's got a conductor at the 12 o'clock. It's a rectangular piece of material, no gap. There's a conductor, there's a wire connected to it at 12 o'clock. There's a wire connected to it at 6 o'clock. A battery is supplying voltage across the two. That's making a current flow through the semiconductor material. I have a voltage sensing device between the wire at the 9 o'clock position and the 6 o'clock position of this slab of material. No gap of any kind. I turned it on. Current flow is from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock. No differential voltage appears between 9 o'clock and 6 o'clock. I pick up my bar magnet. I hold it near the Hall effect device. The current flowing, the particles of current flowing between 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock get deflected. I now see a differential voltage between 9 o'clock and 6 o'clock on this slab of semiconductor material. There's no gap. That is the pure Hall effect device. Yes, I can install it in the gap of a JAWS or a Clampon ammeter. I haven't done that yet. That senses magnetic field, and it does not sense any E field of the outside world. KCQ, QIQ, K2RIW.
Okay, you're talking about the Hall effect transducer. That is this device that you're talking about. There is no pathways around the transducer. Okay, is that what you're talking about, sir?
Yay, verily. That Hall effect transducer, that slab of material on the table, senses nothing but H field, if I'm using it correctly. It doesn't give a damn about what E field is in its environment. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
I believe that what you're going to see there, Dick, is that the transducer is optimized for H field sensing. Yes, you're absolutely correct. The transducer is optimized for H field sensing. But if you were to put an electrostatic field around the outside, eventually it will reflect as well. What its actual hold-off is on E-field, I'm not sure how much isolation it has, but eventually it will be disturbed with a large enough E-field.
Okay. Assume now I've got this Hall-effect transducer. I was not smart enough to use those words earlier. My bar magnet nearby, and because of the presence of the bar magnet near the transducer, I measured, let me pick a number, 10 millivolts of difference between 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock. The power supply that's supplying the current flowing through the transducer between 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock happens to be, let me pick a number, a 4-volt battery. At the center tap of the 4-volt battery, I bring a wire out to the outside world. I connect it to a 10,000-volt power supply, positive lead. And the negative lead, I ground to my local ground in my laboratory. As I turn on that 10,000-volt power supply, connected to the common center tap of the battery that's running the transducer, I say that the transducer will not change in its response to that bar magnet. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Of course, because what's happening is the Hall effect transducer, that device, needs to look at a very, very strong H field, first of all. They don't measure, they're actually very, very poor H field detectors when they need a very, very strong local H field in order to get those to deflect. And the difference between, I would say, the ability for it to measure an H field, which is kind of limited, they're kind of, it takes a strong signal of H. I would say that for E, there's probably almost another 90 dB of isolation between E fields in a detector.
Okay, if the detector is 90 dB, minus 90 dB sensitive to E fields, and it senses H fields, that's close enough to ideal for me. Also, if I buy the right Hall effect transducer, and if that differential op amp connected to it can measure millivolts, microvolts, nanovolts, I buy a real low noise op amp between the 9 o'clock and 6 o'clock position, I think I can make that Hall effect device, by my standards, very sensitive. I believe, and I remember using a Hall effect device once. It was in a little integrated circuit package. I think if I took one of John's neodymium metals and held it 5 feet away, I believe I would measure the H field in that Hall effect device 5 feet away. That's sensitive enough for me, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I think you're going to be disappointed, Dick, because I can give you an idea right now. If you were to use close the field so that you put a piece of wire in the middle, when you start getting down to like 1 milliamp, it's very, very difficult. hole probes measure 1 millionth in wire with one of those sensors. You know, you're looking at like, you know, 20 millionths and above. They're actually pretty useful. At 1 millionth, you're really in the mud. And that's for the core, closing the path around one of those devices. If you were just sitting open to the path or a neodymium magnet, I would suspect that you'll probably start to see something when you get within 2 inches of that device.
I'm going to agree with you on the sensing of 1 millionth. And you and I can calculate how much magnetic field, 1 millionth in a wire, how much magnetic field exists in that clamp-on ammeter draws. It's very small. It ain't a Tesla. I think we're talking about a micro Tesla here, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm just pointing out to you is that when you're taking a magnet, okay, just in free space like that, and you bring it to that device, the path length is so long that I think you're going to have to be within inches of that device, maybe even less than inches, before you can start seeing the deflection when you're within the magnet, you know, near that sensor device.
Okay. Let me propose another example here now. I've got my Hall Effect device running. I take a very small ball magnet, and let's say that the north pole of my ball magnet gives me, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 1 millitesla. And I get a certain number of microvolts out of my Hall Effect device. I now take away the small little ball magnet, and I take this other ball magnet that I've made that is 10 yards long, and it only has a very minor amount of magnetization, so that once again the North Pole is putting out 1 millitesla, and therefore the Hall Effect device, when I hold it at the same distance from the North Pole end, is going to give me the same indication. But now that second bar magnet is double long, but the magnetic path is closed outside of the vicinity of the measurement by a very long path. I say the Hall Effect device doesn't give a damn. As long as the number of millitesla at the north pole of the short bar magnet or the huge long bar magnet, as long as the north pole has the exact same magnetic field at that position, whether the path of closure is long or short, the Hall Effect device doesn't care. Agree or disagree? K2LIW?
I completely agree, Dick. It's just that the amplitude of that signal, of that H field, or the line of flux that you'll be measuring, is probably going to be very, very small in amplitude.
But you're telling me that the length of the magnetic path matters to the measurement. I think it does not. As long as the number of lines of flux flowing through the Hall Effect transducer are the same, whether that be a very small path or a very long path, as long as, for argument's sake, all of the lines of flux across the whole surface of the Hall Effect transducer are uniform, it doesn't care if the magnetic path is long or short. It is measuring the local H field effect on the transducer, and properly calibrated and properly run, I think it can tell a kind of a truth traceable to the Bureau. K2LIW.
Yeah, the point that I'm making, Dick, is if you hold a neodymium magnet, or any magnet for that matter, and you were to draw the lines of flux around the magnet, which will find out that the initial path length of that field is very tightly wrapped around the magnet itself. In other words, you'll find that those lines of flux that follow between the north and the south pole are tightly tucked around the magnet, and that the stray fields that come out further and further and further away from the magnet in terms of lines of flux, the amplitude of those H fields, the amount of force that's in that in those stray fields as you get further and further away from the magnet and the static magnet, are very, very, very amplitude is really what I'm saying. But yes, you're right. The Hall Effect transducer, it doesn't really care, you know, what the amplitude is. I mean, it's just looking for a specific amplitude. It doesn't really care the distance as long as the amplitude is the amplitude. I'm just saying with the magnet, when you get far enough away from it, you're going to find that those fields are very, very deep.
Okay. What initiated this particular discussion we're in for the last few minutes? calculating that a properly used Hall effect transducer is 99.9% sensitive to H field only, and properly used, it completely ignores E field. If I wanted a pure H field sensor, I believe a Hall effect transducer comes pretty close to what I'm looking for. Agree or disagree, K2LAW?
From that standpoint, I agree with you. I think the unfortunate problem is, I think your next step that you're going to say is that you're going to try to do it to measure RF. And I think what you're going to find out is that if you were to take that device and put it in the chamber and start blasting it with some pretty strong HF energy or VHF energy, microwave, whatever, try to find the sensitive frequency that will probably be the most going to be most reactive to you. It's going to take a lot of energy before you start really measuring much on it.
I think I'm going to agree with you there, Glenn. I've kept you long enough. It's late enough. You and I are slowly understanding each other's vocabulary, and we've made progress from my point of view. I thank you for hanging there so long under such terrible conditions, and don't want to push this too far, otherwise you'll be afraid to get into the next discussion next week. I hope you can come back again next week, Glenn. As I said a number of times, with all of your experience with transformers and switching power supplies and so on, you're the smartest guy I know of in magnetics. And I've got a bunch of magnetic hypotheses that I'm trying to pin down. Therefore, I'm bouncing them off you. I'm trying to pick your brain on them. And I'd like to do more of that next week. 73, you all. Thank you. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Glenn Dick, can you hear me?
Always a pleasure, Dick. Keep up with KC2QIQ, 73. Have a good weekend, nice. Hopefully you had a test tomorrow too, like I do, and enjoy the day. And hopefully next time we'll have better communication. One more time, K2IW, KC2QIQ, 73.
Bye-bye, Glenn. For those guys who really care, if you're still there, this was TechNet number 1437 of the series that began way back in September of 1982. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And we'll try to solve a couple more of the laws of physics next week. K2LAW clear.
Hey, you guys forgot about me and my question. Okay, thank you very much. Have a good night.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.
GPS says 30 miles to go, and I have 2 hours to get there, so Hopefully I will make it.
Well, you should. I know they had the speed restriction on the bridge of 30 miles an hour before, which I had to heed because both of my trailers were fairly empty. I had 30% in the lead trailer and only 10% in the rear trailer. So they tend to get pushed around just a little bit in the wind. So I made sure I heeded their advice, went over nice and slow. Since everybody else is passing me, but they can do what they want. I'll take the safe way.
Okay, very good. So I have a deep respect for wind. My second hobby is glider flying. Not model, but actual gliders. I fly out of Gabreski out east. The glider I fly is called Blanik L-23. About a 32-foot fuselage and a 53-foot wingspan. And when the wind is cranking, it can make it interesting for flying, let me tell you.
Hey, I can imagine. I had a close family friend probably about 30 years ago, I guess. He was into, maybe more, 30, 40 years, I guess. He was into glider flying. And became an instructor. He's moved out of state now. I'm not sure. I think he's out on the West Coast. Have kind of lost touch with him. But he was always big into that. I always wanted to go up with him sometime and see that. It's really almost like you feel like you're like a bird. There's no noise. There's just the wind noise a little bit, and it's just nice. And you read the thermals. Like you said, you get real good at reading the wind. And when it gets gusty, I can imagine you really got your hands full. So, there must be a cutoff point at some point too, with crosswinds where they won't let you go up, or they won't release you, right?
Yeah, for takeoff, the limit on the aircraft I fly is 16 knots crosswind. And they don't release us, we release from them. If they released us, we would get stuck with the 200 feet of rope on the nose of the aircraft. So we release from them, but for takeoff, 16 knot crosswind is the maximum that we can take off.
Okay. I wonder what your longest flight time was. What it could be.
Well, quite a bit of signal sensing on that time. I don't know if it was the echo link or where I am on the throg. Stand by. They just shut down a lane on me here. Now they open it back up. Thank you very much. I haven't had that happen to me in a long time. It's like approaching a lane and then all of a sudden they shut it down. Then they open it back up as soon as I change lanes. Let's see if I can remember what your question was. Flight time, it depends on the thermals, but 1 to 2 hours is normal. My longest flight is 4. Highest I've been is about 8,500 feet.
Well, that's pretty good. That kind of 1 or 2 hours would be, I think, more than enough for a lot of people. But after 4 hours climbing out of that, I bet you're a little bit stiff. I know what it's like when I get out from behind the wheel, and if I do like a 6 or 8 hour leg, sometimes without actually doing any stopping, and I get out and I'm all bent over, it takes a while to get the blood flow to the limbs again. Sometimes I try to make more frequent stops, but and if I'm feeling good or running a little behind schedule, I'll tend to push it a little bit. But especially if I'm working nights or if I'm on the night shift, then I usually stop at least once every 2 to 3 hours, even if I just get out, walk around the truck once to get back in again, just to help both to keep awake, especially when it's just cold out.
Well, based on that comment, then you'll appreciate my following comment. A lot of people ask me, what's the limiting factor on how long I can stay up? Now, is it wind? Is it thermal? No. What's the limiting factor? And the limiting factor is usually the ladder capacity. I usually can get the airplane for time to stay up, but usually it's the ladder that dictates when I come down. W2PB.
Okay. I'm laughing because I know exactly what you mean. So sometimes I have to make preemptive stops. Like I'll see a rest area coming up in 2 or 3 miles, and I'll pull still in there, even though I may not have to use it, because I'm guaranteed as soon as I pass it, the next one is 45 minutes away. That's when I'm going to need one. So you try to, I'm on a dedicated one, so I know where all of them are. I can pretty much pace myself out, though, plan stuff and that. But, yeah, it's the capacity of the bladder. That would definitely limit the time aloft. Have you ever had to, where you lose wind and you had to come down not at the airport, like in a field somewhere?
No, it hasn't happened to me yet, but that just means it hasn't happened yet. Quite a few of my friends have done that. It's called landing out. I've been flying. This will be my 11th season flying gliders. I haven't landed out yet, but it just means my time hasn't come yet.
Okay, 11 years doing it. That's pretty good. Imagine it should be quite relaxing. And to go up early in the morning and maybe catch the sunrise. Or you probably want to wait till after the sun's been up, I guess, to heat and stuff up so you get thermals. Maybe later in the day, so you catch a sunset, might be nice too. But and again, you certainly don't want to get caught up after dark.
Yeah, Roger that. Well, it's illegal for me to fly after dark because the glider does not have a logical system. Therefore, there is no lights on the glider, so can't fly after dark. And my favorite time to go up is normally around 1 to 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's usually the best time for thermals that have built or are still in the process of building. Now, from 1 to 4 is usually the best time. Now, there are some days that you'll get, a very cool evening, and then a warm morning, and thermals will build early. But normally, I try to go up about 1 o'clock.
Okay, K2UPS mobile. Now, obviously, your speed is considerably less than any powered aircraft, but I wonder if you've had, or is it uncommon to have a bird strike in a glider?
Oh, no. I've gone up and come very close to that. And it's not all that uncommon. It does happen. And the first thing I do once I release from the aircraft and I get out of his way and I scout around for a thermal, usually the first thing I do is put the glider into what's called slow foot. And I slow the airplane down to about 41 knots or about 46 miles an hour, 47 miles an hour, and I just lumber along, minding my own business. Unless I'm doing some mild acrobatics, I just meander around and keep the speed down someplace between 46 and 50 miles an hour.
That's interesting. I average usually 65 to 70 miles an hour when I'm on the road. So that's considerably less. Have you ever taken an HT up with you?
Yeah, one day of insanity, I took my HT up with me, and needless to say, as soon as I turned on the dual-band HT, air traffic control got busy, and I wound up having to turn it back off because I had to concentrate on the traffic around me. So I've taken it up, I've turned it on, but I've never made a transmission.
Okay, I imagine you get up at some altitude there, and makes a pretty nice either long distance repeater contact or even simplex work. So that'd be kind of interesting. I'm gonna be bringing my HT with me next month when it's Dayton weekend. I have an app. The only radio that I do from the truck is what I'm doing now on Echolink. But I have an APRS app in the phone also that I could beacon. And I can change the message then to contact me on 146.52 Simplex. I'll bring the HT along. Dayton weekend is hams all over the place on the road. So you can pick them out pretty easy just by looking for the antennas. And then, of course, I can track them on the APRS map, too, to see where they are. But I've brought it out a few times with me on the road and haven't made too many contacts. Once in a while, I'll come up next to a ham, but the chances that they're monitoring is probably less than 50-50. Although some of the motorhomes usually monitor that. If I see private vehicles, not so much, but when I see motorhomes with call sign plates, chances are fairly good that you can catch them listening on Simplex.
Yeah, roger that. I retired, or at least semi-retired, July of 11, and I used to work in California and live here, you know, and I used to drive from Los Angeles to Las Vegas a lot. Couldn't scare up a call, or a QSO on any simplex frequency, any band if you had to. Same thing when I used to drive down to San Diego, just seems like no one monitors simplex frequencies anymore. Sometimes they don't even monitor the repeaters. So. Usually if I want to contact, my best chance is to bring it up on GMRS, do it that way. Let's see, just going through Yonkers now, 19 miles to go. So anyway, Rich, I'm going to say 7-3s. I got a traffic building in front of me, I'm alive. So I'll say 7-3s, hope you're working again, and I'll listen out for your final. W2PV, have a great day. Get some sleep.
Okay, Paul, it was nice chatting with you this morning. Well, you have a good day. Hopefully it'll be a short day for you. And we'll look for you again. W2PB, K2UPS Mobile.
something weird happened. Neil, are you there?
Yeah, it could be this radio. I'm using the old backup rig in the Buick.
No, it wasn't you. The repeater went offline for a minute there because I couldn't even key it up.
No, it could have been me. What happens on this radio every now and then, and it has to do with the mic, is it'll drop a tone and it locks the repeater because I'm still talking.
That makes sense, except that I would have seen the repeater, you know, at full S9 on my meter, and it was just like dead as a doornail, at least on my transceiver.
Yeah, it used to happen with this radio before when I used to use it. Every now and then, if I don't press the mic button the right way, when I drop a tone, the repeater locks me out, but also locks everybody else out until I unkey.
I gotcha. What I said, I don't know if you heard me, I said I wasn't sure if my antenna is tuned for 75 meters. I think the most I've ever gone down, gone up, which is however you want to look at it, is 40 meters. I've had some QSOs on. I don't think I've ever gone up to 80 or 75 for that matter. I'll have to see. I'll play with my receiver at home and see.
Yeah, I know I have pretty disastrous results when I do it. I can go down to 40 meters and no lower with the antenna I have. So, but my latest modification to it, I can do 40 and 15 now, so it tunes up on everything 40 through 10. I'm pretty happy with that. I know I'm not getting optimum performance with an odd-shaped wire thrown into the trees in the front yard, but I am getting out. I've made some good contacts on all bands, so we'll see. And I was saying, I hope they make a multi-band or at least, you know, different band options on that rig. It would be nice.
60 PC Mobile.
All recognized. Good morning. It's Jay and Neil. Why don't you take it, then pass it over to Neil. Go ahead, Al. Over to you.
Very good. Good morning, fellas. I was just listening. Yeah, to get work up on AP, just get yourself a roller inductor or some inductance, throw it in series with the antenna if you're using a random wire, and you'll get 80 meters. It's no big deal. It'll work very well. Go ahead, over.
Yeah, I have a decent tuner. I know it doesn't have a roller inductor in it, so that would be a nice upgrade. But we don't intend to be where we are permanently, and my next place may have better options, so I'm going to wait and see. But for now, I'm content with going as low as 40. I know there's a lot of activity on 80, 75 at night, but it gets a little crazy down there, too. It seems like it's almost hard to find a clear channel when the band is in good shape. So, oh, we'll see. I know I've got a couple other options I can do, too, so I've been looking into it. But for now, I just don't want to do anything more where I'm living. I'll wait and see where I end up. Jay?
Neil? Yeah, Hal, I have a fan dipole that I'm using, and I have it cut for 40, 20, 17, 15, 10. So, 80 doesn't work real well. I probably get about 1.5 to 2 on SWR. But I usually don't go down that low anyway. So that's why 75 to me seemed like an odd band to choose to make a fixed transceiver on. But they might have had a reason for it. I'm not sure. Over to you.
Yeah, well, really, you know, I know what you mean, Jay. But as far as it goes, like you have a fan dipole, just take your center conductor and your outside shield, put them together, go into your tuner, and let your feed line and everything work. It'll be a flat top, and you'll be able to resonate it on 80. Just use a good ground.
That's an interesting idea. You pass it over to J, W2NDG.
Hi, okay. I missed the one thing. What is a flat top?
Okay, well, when you come up to the top of the antenna, and then you have a T, that's considered to be a flat top. You take your feed line and use your whole feed line as your radiating element plus your T of the antenna, because you're putting both things together. And it'll work. As long as you have a ground on it, it should work pretty well. And as far as, you know, your problem, you say you don't have a rotary coil tuner, you don't really need that, because what you can do is just wind a fixed inductance up on a core, you know, on just a hole. It depends how much power you're running. If you don't have a lot of power, you can use a toilet paper tube, wind up an inductance, put it in series with that random wire you got, and get the frequency to be lower, and you'll get it to resonate on 80. Doesn't take much. I work mobile on 80 with a 102-inch loaded antenna. I've worked all over the East Coast with like 100 watts. Go ahead.
Hey. Yeah, I mean, a couple of the NFED antennas I'm looking at come with that. That's I guess, how they function. So I could just, one of them, they even give you the plans for the box so you can make it yourself. With a couple of inductors in it. So, I could do that. We'll have to see. But, yeah, the antenna was a hell of a lot shorter before, and I was able to tune it up on 40. And 1.5 to 2, Jay, doesn't sound horrible. I think that would actually function. It's not ideal, but probably better than what I'm getting on some of the bands that I'm tuning up.